This is episode number 28 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, September 6, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. In this special edition of the podcast, we took the show on the road to the recent PFF Aspen Summit. On the last day of the conference, we held one of our occasional Alcohol Liberation Front get-togethers and recorded some TLF contributors and other special guests. We start with Bill Rosenblatt of DRMWatch.com on why fair use might just be a quaint old notion that's on its way out the door.
You were at the panel today, Bill, about content, and you and Stan Leibowitz, and I think Solvik to some extent, also subscribed to this, made a comment that was interesting to me, which is that fair use is becoming more and more a quaint notion, that in a few years, a few dozen years, who knows what, might go the way of a dodo. Can you explain to me what that means and why you think that?
Okay, so basically the problem with fair use is that you need a court to decide it. And the whole idea of these digital content technologies is to make things happen immediately. And whenever you're in a situation where you have to revert to the legal system to figure out whether you can or cannot do something, you lose. Because it's the legal system is a very slow-moving and clunky and inefficient mechanism compared to technology. So everyone loves the fact that digital media can be distributed instantaneously and very, very cheaply. But when there are these deliberations about what's kosher and what's not kosher, you're often in the realm of deciding on fair use, which is principle-based law, which is unique to this country. Nobody else has it. The UK and other UK-derived countries like Canada and Australia have a similar law, but it's not principle-based. It's more factually based. And then in Europe, you've got a law that basically says you're allowed to make a copy of something for your own use, period, which is much easier to represent in technology. So that's the problem with fair use.
But don't you have certain uses of content? And you have to understand, again, that, and maybe you might disagree with me, that copyright isn't an absolute right. It's sort of something like that Congress has the power to grant to a content creator and shape it in a certain way. And that there are certain, you know, values that folks can draw from creating, you know, from basically taking ideas, using a little bit of it, and creating something new. And there's value there that you would shut off completely if you didn't have a fair use principle. So you're saying basically that value is just so minute at this point.
But you're talking about what's been called cut and paste culture,
right?
Basically, which is a very controversial topic. You know, and I'm not going to venture an opinion on whether that's good or bad. I have no opinion on that. But there's no reason why fair use has to be the mechanism that decides that or not. My feeling, which is an unconventional opinion and probably one that no lawyer would ever share, and I'm not a lawyer, is fair use, in order to be made to work at all, needs to be expressed in ways that technology can accommodate.
So what's the alternative? I mean, Microsoft, I forget his name, maybe you can remind me.
Ruben?
That's right. At the panel was talking about the fingerprinting system, where the content providers provide a database, and whenever anything is submitted to their video sharing platform, they check it against that.
Right.
My question is, well, what if I'm using a couple seconds of some content that's copyrighted to illustrate a topic? Say I'm doing a, you know, documentary about Italian Americans in film, and I have a couple seconds of The Godfather. That's kicked out. That doesn't help anybody. And so I guess, what's the alternative? How do you automate that?
Well, first of all, whether or not your couple seconds of a film is kicked out using a fingerprinting system depends on how the fingerprinting system is implemented. It could be implemented in such a way as to allow snippets of that length. But getting back to my previous point, there needs to be a determination of how many seconds is the dividing line between fair and not fair.
And you don't want a court to be doing that. You would like it to be a much more mechanical.
Well, you know, if I happen to prefer market-based solutions. You know, I'm in line with PFF on this. I'm not a fan of government trying to write a whole bunch of laws that become obsolete before they're enacted. But my point is, for example, the state of California a couple years ago enacted a very interesting law that nobody seems to talk about, but I think is extremely interesting. And the law says that if you transmit, I'll make it simple for the sake of efficiency. If you email a piece of copyrighted content to more than 10 people, then you must identify the work and yourself in the message. Now, so what is that? That is a legal requirement. It's basically a stake in the ground that says, if you're sending it to less than 10 people, it's probably okay. If you're sending it to more than 10 people, it's probably not okay. This is the kind of technologically feasible determination that needs to happen if fair use is not going to be a millstone around digital media.
Next, Jim Harper and yours truly follow up with Solveig Singleton on the obsolete fair use question.
Hi, Jim Harper here. I'm with Solveig Singleton, who put together a panel this morning on getting to Let's Make a Deal, trying to get content and technology together. Now, I admit to you, Solveig, that I kind of had my face down in my laptop for part of your session, and I heard some interesting discussion about fair use. I think I heard Stan Leibowitz talk about fair use as anachronistic. And etc. I wonder if you can sort of summarize what he said, and I think you sort of partially endorse what he was saying. If you want to sort of recap in a well done DRM world, maybe fair use goes away. Was the sense I got of what I heard?
I'm not exactly certain what version of this theory that Stan was getting at, but this is what I think he was talking about. Fair use as a free market concept makes sense if you think about fair use as a legal doctrine which comes into play when you have a situation where the user wants to do something, but it's really not, they're not in a good position to negotiate a license. So, for example, you want to quote something, you know, chances are you're not going to go and negotiate a license to quote some teeny tiny little excerpt. Now, suppose you could, in fact, almost instantaneously, at almost no cost, negotiate a license to quote this tiny little thing for a fraction of a cent. Well, once that becomes possible, arguably, you no longer need an exception from copyright law in order to do it. Now, I think that that's actually it's not really a very extreme argument. And in some cases, it's actually been recognized by courts of appeals. You know, once you get a market for little snippets and bits, if somebody then starts taking the snippets and bits and not paying, they can't defend on grounds of fair use. Now, here's the thing. This is easily misunderstood, because I think fair use often gets used very broadly as a generic term for any kind of limitation or exemption on copyright law. So, but properly understood, the argument that fair use can evolve away and needs to change over time, it's really a pretty narrow one. It doesn't mean that there shouldn't be outer limits to copyright, that there can't be exemptions to copyright. It just means they don't necessarily need to take the form of fair use. For example, there's a hugely important outer limit. You can't copyright ideas or facts. That's not fair use. That's just copyright law doesn't go there. Transformative use, another one. That's not fair use. That's transformative use. There's other ways you can get to exemptions from copyright law by thinking about different ways to think about what's a copy exactly, what's a performance exactly.
Now, I mean, the thing is, I understand the instinct to want to get the courts out of this and try to get the judgment out of it. But how is an automated system going to recognize a transformative use?
Well, let me stick to just fair use. I think there is an area where, even if you take the transaction costs argument seriously, fair use can never evolve away, and that's where you have a conflict of interest between the creator and the end user. Parity is an example. You know, even if people might not want to be parity, it wouldn't matter how low the transaction costs are, that would be very hard to license. So there's still going to be a role for it.
I'll tell you, when I, again, listening with only one ear, when I heard that, I thought to myself, oh my heavens, the fair use allows a lot of promotion to be done for things. So if somebody wants to write a review of a book and they quote part of it, that would not be allowed in what he was describing. I understand a little bit better that if there was a system for sort of automatically doing it. There are difficult details in creating such a system, I think, where, for example, someone uses a character from a copyrighted piece of material, but there is no way to there's nothing in the copyrighted material that can communicate about this other use of a copyrighted concept, like a storyline or a character. You're not actually using a piece of the digitally created material. So then you maybe would have to bifurcate fair use into quotation. Actual use of digitized material could be subject to this regime, but other forms of fair use, such as modifying a storyline or, you know, using a character in some way that is within fair use now, couldn't be negotiated digitally. So it was a very interesting thing to me, and it illustrates to me how really, really broad the range of opinions and ideas is on copyright. There are a lot of interesting things yet to work through in this area. So
back to your question.
Yeah. You want to continue?
Yeah. Okay. Back to your question. You know, how does a thing recognize a transformative use? Well, it probably can't. I think that, and I'm not sure, since transformative uses don't need to be licensed, if you can think of a way around it and use it in a transformative use, you can do that. If you can't think of a way around it, then there's other, you know, there's other tricks you can play.
But it sounds to me that when Bill Rosenblatt, and maybe you should just be really speaking for him, and Stan Leibowitz and yourself, when you say that fair use is going away, you don't really mean that. You mean it as fair use as an all-encompassing, basically hole that sucks up everything in there. And I think there really is a disagreement there. But when you're talking about parity, transformative uses, and things like of that nature, you agree that there's still room for that there.
There's all kinds of outer limits. There's all kinds of exceptions. It's just they don't necessarily need to be dressed up in fair use, which is a very complicated legal concept that I'm not certain entirely serves the consumer demand for simplicity very well.
I agree with the complaints about fair use as a judge-made doctrine originally, that then was put into statute using these sort of factors that judges originally came up with. The simple way to do fair use, if I could wave a wand, would be if the material that for which fair use is being claimed is in economic competition with the original work or within the likely sort of product of the originator of the copyrighted material, then the competition would say, no, that's not fair use. But all other uses that aren't in economic competition with the original work could be fair use. And that would be a simpler way of administering it and get us away from the sort of multi-factor test that is so subjective and obviously leads to so many disputes and continuous litigation and disputes.
Finally, Adam Thierer talks to Declan McCullough of CNetNews.com about the specter of data retention mandates. Solveig Singleton and yours truly also pipe in.
We've got Declan McCullough here, and we want to ask you, I mean, what you heard today on Solveig's panel and others about things like this question of deputizing the middleman and the role of fair use. I mean, what were some of your thoughts about what came out of Aspen or what some people said and where you think that debate's heading?
Fair questions all. One thing that I liked about the panel today, this morning, involving Content DRM, was the interplay between Microsoft and then and the audience, Google. Microsoft saying, hey, look, I mean, we go out of our way to protect copyright on our version of a video sharing site, and Google, you bastards, you don't. What's wrong with you? I mean, obviously, Microsoft makes its money from selling copyrighted materials. Google makes its money from ads, its different incentives, and all that. But that was a nice interchange. I was hoping to see more on data retention. I mean, this goes to Adam's point about deputizing the middleman. ISPs as agents of the cops, so it would be nice to have a panel on that. So, Adam, do it next year.
Well, we did have a discussion about data retention at our dinner on free speech issues, and Bob Pepper of Cisco had some interesting comments. And the interesting thing about the data retention debate, I think you'd agree, is that there are a lot of people in a lot of different industries that seem to be unified in their concern about how broad the scope is of any sort of a data retention mandate, what the length of it is, the breadth of it is. I don't think we have answers there yet, but you've written a lot of stories, Declan, about this. I mean, do you care to, you know, have any sort of prediction about where that debate's heading? Because it strikes me the only thing that's headed off that debate this year was the fact that Attorney General Gonzalez got in so much hot water politically that he didn't have any political cachet on the Hill to cash in to go out and actually pursue these data retention mandates. If not for that, we might have been facing legislation this year. Do you think that's right?
In large part, yeah. I mean, the problem that Gonzalez made is that the issue probably got too tied up with him personally. It became too closely tied with him, and if it would have been a broader DOJ priority, then he might have had some traction, especially if he got some Democrats in at the beginning. But it's kind of odd that you see the industry moving towards keeping less data and keeping the data they do keep for shorter periods of time, and you see even bills introduced in the House last year that would limit data retention, thinking the Markey bill, and all of a sudden you see the Bush administration pushing for mandatory data retention, not just for ISPs, but also search engines. I mean, they've been in these meetings, and DOJ officials have been talking about, like, let's keep search records. Who knows how long? Maybe 2 or 3 years. It's not just ISPs, it's also search. News.com, NYTimes.com, we also have many search engines for our own database, and so it'd be kind of useful to know who goes to some of these sites, dictionary.com, Wikipedia, and types in certain keywords. How about murder? Who knows?
Thought on this. This is Solvay again. I think it would be helpful to point out to any regulator who suggests this that, okay, take your own medicine here. How about retaining the data from the uses of the internet, the searches and so on, that are conducted through your office?
See, the problem with that is this is exactly why it's deputizing. If you do it that way, there's a case to be made that this is a search and seizure, right? So it's an illegal search. And this is why they can't do it themselves, and they have to deputize the private companies to do it and just sort of just hold it in this free, apparently free hard drive space until the day that they need
exactly
to come out and get it.
Because they would rather pass along the unfunded mandate to someone in industry to do it and obviously not pick up themselves.
And it's not just an unfunded mandate. It may well be unconstitutional for them to
That's
do
right.
it themselves.
Hold on. This is Declan again. All of what you say is correct, of course, but this does lead to the idea of a possible schism between libertarians, civil libertarians, privacy advocates, and their often allies in industry. If industry gets written a very large check, hey, here's $1 billion, go and implement data retention, then all of a sudden they might well say, sure, we'll go along with it. This is what happened in Kalia. Not everyone will, but you can imagine that AT&T, Verizon are much more likely to than smaller ISPs. Earthlink, for instance, has made a point of being privacy protective. So if those checks are written, then we have some problems.
Well, that's it for this special edition of Tech Policy Weekly. To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. See you next time.